Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Doubters on Thursday, the 8th of October. And welcome to our guest today, Tom Waterhouse, who's joining us from his home in Switzerland, his basement in Switzerland, actually. How's life for you over there today?
It's good. It's good. It's been a very, very lively day. I'm sure we may touch on why.
We may touch on that, yeah. We'll say why in a minute, yeah.
Absolutely.
Great. Good to have you here. So,
thank you. Just, pleasure to be here.
Yeah, just in case anybody's joining us for the first time, this is The Doubters. This is my private online community, a space where we embrace, or we aim to embrace, self-doubt as a route to meaningful and sustainable growth. And I use this space as an exploratory learning space. I love having these conversations that relate to all the different aspects around this. And today, our topic is, if I had been born a girl. I'll explain a little bit more about that in just a second. Yeah. And we've got one person join us here live. And we'll see. The waiting room's off, so hopefully people will come and join us. Yeah, just to say, anybody, you know, everybody's welcome to come and join us, but there's no pressure to join in, but you're welcome to anyway. So, I'll introduce our guest today. So Tom Waterhouse is an independent consultant dealing in the area of equity and diversity, and the host of the brand new podcast, If I Had Been Born a Girl. And when I say brand new, I mean brand new. It's like the first episode's dropped today.
Literally,
is that right?
Today. Yes,
yeah.
Exactly,
so that's why it's been a bit of a hectic day for you. Yeah.
I was on the phone with my brother-in-law at 3 o'clock this morning.
Oh, wow.
Talking about the website and things like that, which isn't ready, but.
Oh,
you know.
Well.
A great exercise in managing one's self-doubt, you could say.
For sure, we'll get on to talking about that. Well, just to say, I love the website. I think it's great. I think you've done a great job. And the launch has been fantastic. And I listened to half the first episode already. So we'll get into talking a bit more what that is. But just to say, the podcast is, and actually, I'm just going to read this from your description because I love the way you describe it. You say, your mission is to help men better understand the ubiquitous and pervasive nature of sexism and systemic gender discrimination by encouraging them to explore the impact on their lives of gender stereotyping and male privilege, challenge them to ask themselves, how did I really get to where I am today? Really bold project. And I like to introduce people by my connection with them. So just to say how I met you, Tom, we met last November at an event in London. Absolutely. And it just seems like another world now to think about, you know, going into London to meet somebody.
It doesn't just seem like it was another world.
It was another world, doesn't it, literally. Yeah. Going into London and meeting somebody face-to-face in an event. But we met through Dori Clark, who I'm a massive fan of Dori Clark. And I just tend to think anybody I meet for her, I know, has, you know, makes excellent decisions and choices anyway, because that filters out a lot. So is there anything that you want people to know about you before we start, Tom?
I'm not sure that there's anything I need people to know about me, other than that I'm a father and a grandfather. And actually, my children and my grandchildren are the same age.
Okay.
A child from my first marriage is now adult. And so, you know, I suppose the other thing is to say that I left the corporate world more recently than you did.
Yeah.
I left the corporate world about 18 months ago, and that experience, together with the experience of being a father and being a parent, have really had a significant influence on the way I think about what I do, and particularly about the question of self-doubt and the prism through which I look at self-doubt.
Wow, interesting. Well, I love how you really put that out there at the beginning. It's quite an interesting family dynamic, and also this is how I relate to what you're doing. So thank you for bringing that, and I'm sure we'll get into that. And just to say, you know, that leaving the corporate world and coming out and doing, you know, putting your name on something as you're doing, and we're doing, and as you know, people, you know, Mark is doing also on this call, it's a huge challenge. And, you know, in a way, we can protect ourselves from self-doubt by not doing this stuff.
Exactly.
So self-doubt is, I think, can be a really healthy and important part of the process.
Indeed.
So let's get into this. So I'm really just curious to know a little bit about the background of this this project of yours, you know, challenging men to think about gender stereotyping and male privilege by asking them this question, if I had been born a girl. So you could just give us a little bit of the background and where it came from.
Sure. So I'm a relatively recent convert, not quite the right word, but I'm relatively new to the world of diversity and inclusion. My background from a professional perspective was first in IT and then in strategic project management, and I moved into the human resources area about 10 years ago, and I guess about 5 or 6 years ago started working on diversity and inclusion, trying to basically get it onto the corporate agenda of my last employer, which was not an easy task. It was a very old-fashioned patriarchal company, and even the business case didn't really resonate at first, so there was a lot of work to be done there. And I left that company early last year and realized, well, first things first, I left on International Women's Day, and the very last thing I did at the company was make a public press announcement that the company had obtained certification in gender equality. And I literally, you know, pressed the button on send and walked out of the office. And, you know, when I left, it very rapidly became clear to me that the subject which I'd been most passionate about in my last few years working there had been diversity and inclusion. And the focus in that company was very much on gender equality, because it just wasn't mature enough to talk about any other kind of diversity issues. But the subject had played a part in my life for a while. But having the time to sit down and think, I started to ask myself the question, how can I now, as an individual, no longer as a member of an organization, how can I continue working in this area, and how can I have some impact? And so I did two things. I reflected a lot about where my interest in the subject came from and why it suddenly became so important to me. And then I looked at what I thought I could bring as an individual to the table.
Hmm.
So the where, I think, you know, I won't go through my whole personal history, but, you know, I was able to trace back incidents in my career which had kind of, which I'd raised an eyebrow at the time, but little more. And then I was able to trace, if you like, a gradual progression towards frustration significant enough that I felt the need and the desire to do something about it. And then I had the birth of my child, my daughter, who's nearly five. And, you know, I had an adult son, but having a daughter also made me think very differently about the world and bringing a girl into this world. And so all of that, I think, contributed to my interest in the subject. But when I thought about what can I bring to the table, and here's perhaps the first link with self-doubt, I was like, well, I've just come out of a corporate career in which I spent the last 17 years working in one company. I've only been working in the area of diversity and inclusion for 4 or 5 years, the first two or three of which were basically in a sort of underground, unofficial capacity. And I can't come out now and say, I know how to do D&I. No one's going to take me seriously. They're going to say, well, where's your track record? And I'm going to say, well, I have a 5-year track record of mostly failing in a large organization. And so I felt this drive to work on the subject, but at the same time, this immense doubt about my credibility and whether people would take me seriously. And that led me to a question about, well, how can I bring something authentic to the table? Because, you know, I spent a lot of time last year in the months after I left my employer going to conferences and talking to people and reading and watching videos and participating in webinars and all kinds of stuff and doing pro bono work. And so I was building up, if you like, my knowledge of practice, if you like, out in the workplace. But I still felt I still had this thing hanging over me. I can't conscientiously walk into another organization and say, let me tell you how to do it. Because, and so I thought, well, the one thing that I can bring to all of this is my experience as a man. You know, I can't speak for women, and I don't want to speak for women, and I shouldn't speak for women. I can't. It's not for me to tell people what women experience in the workplace. But what I can do is recognize how my privilege as a man, and my privilege is goes far, far beyond just being a man. I am, I like to say I'm a walking incarnation of privilege, because I'm, you know, white, male, straight, cis, educated. My backpack is as full as it can possibly be, and there's probably some stuff left in the corner that I don't take with me. So, but in many areas of my privilege, my experience of it was very, my direct first-hand experience of it was very limited. I did some work last year on racial equity. I was passionate about the subject, and I am passionate about the subject, and one day I want to do something about that. But I've lived in a white bubble all my life, so everything that I know about racial inequality is mostly learned. It's not experienced. And the only area, I could say the same thing actually about LGBTQ or whatever. Mm. I have gay friends, but their gayness was never a key element of our relationship or our friendship. And I never took the opportunity to talk about their experiences.
Yeah.
So the only area in which I felt, you know, I've basically been exposed since the day I was born to my privilege, and I've lived it and I've seen it directly firsthand, is my privilege as a man. And that led me, and I know this is a very long response, and that led me to a last reflection, which was, you know, why did it take me so long actually to wake up to that? Thinking about my own journey to becoming more active, you know, for most of my life I've been a typical Guardian reading progressive liberal. Who would have told people he was a feminist, who was very smug about his liberal progressive values, but actually wasn't lifting a finger and doing anything. And so I started thinking about the journey that it took me to get to a point where I thought, now I realized that I had both a responsibility and the power to do something.
Mm.
And one of the things that struck me was that we don't talk about this. Men don't talk about this. And that's how I came on the idea. It's a very long answer of how I came on the idea of the podcast, and there's other stuff that I'm trying to build around it, which is giving men examples, showing them examples of successful men, men that they respect and that they can admire for what they've achieved, being vulnerable enough to talk about how they achieved what they've achieved, and basically getting to asking them the question. It's not forcing them to recognize or getting them to recognize, it's asking them the question, did you get where you are today solely as a result of your incredible talent and your indefatigable work ethic and your efforts? And, you know, and usually people start laughing before I even get to the end of that question. So it's giving men who maybe are a little bit scared about addressing this question examples of successful men being open and authentic on the subject.
Yeah.
And I should say at this point that one of the drivers behind this project, one of the inspirations behind this project, was some research which was actually done by Matt Wallett, who's my first guest on the first episode.
Mm.
Now the numbers don't really necessarily matter. They're US numbers, and you know they're certainly debatable, but it's not the numbers that matter. It's the concept really behind it. He did some work with a company called PayScale in the US, in which he demonstrated that 20% of men get sexism. They see it, they recognize it, they see it about them, and they're motivated to do something about it. 60% of men actually don't really believe that sexism exists. It's a terrifying number. But I'm not trying to talk to those people. I'm not trying to convert people who don't believe in sexism. What interests me is the other 20%. And the other 20% are basically people just like I was 10 or 15 years ago. They're people who say that they get it, But actually, when you ask them about it, it's kind of an abstract concept that exists beyond their direct experience. Yeah, success, and it's terrible. Of course, it's not in my company. There's no discrimination in my company, but I recognize it. And the consequence is that they don't necessarily engage in any further reflections about whether they're playing a part in sexual discrimination and in the patriarchy and all these scary words. And I guess my objective was to try to talk to those 20% of people, make them feel a little bit more comfortable about reflecting on the question, in the hope that if I can get even a part of that population active, we could be getting much, much closer to a tipping point in terms of seeing real progress on gender equality.
Mm, fantastic. Well, thanks for the background. And you basically answered all the questions as well.
I'm sorry. No, once I start talking about this subject, I tend to...
Well, that's great. No, it's fantastic. And I really actually, I want to start by acknowledging you for the journey that you're going on, approaching this topic, and also, you know, talking about coming from that place of, well, I recognize my privilege, and approaching this anyway, and almost like applying that lens of self-doubt to yourself. Mm-hmm. What have I got to bring here? What have I got to bring? Why are people going to take me seriously? Mm-hmm. And not walking away at that point, you know? So what I recognize is that there must have been enough authentic drive within you for this topic to, you know, to really take you through to where you are now. And that's not an easy journey. It's not an easy task that you're doing here.
I've been enormously supported by other people, I have to say. You know what I mean? And in very different ways. You know, my wife encouraging me, despite the fact that she's scared about the fact that I'm independent and that, you know, the monthly paychecks and things are no longer there. Her support was very much from the sense of, I can just see how much this means to you, know, how passionate you are, and it's so much more agreeable to be around you when you have that. You know, not that I'm a monster or anything, but, you know, I think there was definitely corporate life was eating me from the inside out, and I think if I'd stayed there for much longer, it probably would have had serious consequences. But then the other thing is the number of people. First thing I realized when I came out of the corporate bubble was I was blown away by how generous people are. I participate in a lot of conferences and a lot of workshops and hackathons and things like this, and everywhere I went, people offered me help expecting nothing in return. And not with, even when I didn't ask for it. And I realized that, you know, I'd been in this kind of corporate rat race
where
everyone's in competition with each other. And it just made me, you know, that and people being optimistic. Optimism was something I kind of lost sight of in the corporate world. And a lot of the people I work with, a lot of them have been, they're idealists, you know, they're beyond optimism, they're into it. But actually, it's a really healthy antidote to 30 years of corporate life. And so whatever happens out of all this, just the last 18 months have been amongst the richest of my life, because and a lot of those people telling me, you know, I tell them, I tell my story and about my project perhaps with a little bit more confidence today. But if we'd had this conversation a year ago, which we did, yes. Yeah, that's true. But if we'd had this conversation, you know, public a year ago, people would have sensed that I kind of, well, they'd have seen self-doubt in all its manifestations. They'd have seen someone thinking maybe I've got this really great idea, but actually, you know, shrinking away because thinking of all the criticisms that might be leveled at it and all the people who might say that it's not, you know, it's not quite right and it's not this and it's not that and why are you doing that? And actually, I met a whole lot of people who just said, that's a really great idea, and who almost believed in it more than I did. And told me also, you know, what are you talking about? Why are you worried about your credibility? You've got 30 years of experience. You've got your passion. You've got your belief. You are credible. Yeah. And, you know, if enough people say that to you, then it starts to seep in.
Well, you know, it is such a minefield, this area of diversity and inclusion, isn't it? There's so many different aspects for it. And I believe that we've all got something to bring. We've all got privilege. We've all got disadvantage as well. And often we recognise our disadvantage in our self-doubt. You know, this is a theme in my book. But the more people that are contributing to this conversation, the better.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're using our privilege to and our platforms to address this, then, you know, even better. And, yeah. You know, and of course, there's a momentum happening at the moment, isn't it? And it's great. And it is a really nice arena to be working in, actually.
It is.
You know, the people I've met. I was really captivated. I remember being really captivated by what you're doing. And you said to me about being bored. I was like, wow, you know, it really got me because actually, you know, my experience is that I was bored a girl. My mum didn't want me to be a girl. Well, I came at the end of a long line of boys. So I'm the sixth in the family, right. And the only girls have five big brothers.
Yeah.
And everybody assumed that my mum went on till she had a girl, and she didn't. She actually did not want a girl, you know.
She actually wanted a football team. She wanted 11 boys.
Well, yeah. But she didn't know how to. She didn't know how to be a mother to a girl because she'd had such a difficult relationship with her own mother. Anyway, I've been doing a lot of trauma therapy recently, and I've just realised, you know, actually the impact of that. But anyway, mm-hmm. I shouldn't laugh at that. But anyway, so it's a. You know, not being wanting to be a girl, but actually, no, it did affect me. And I would say I'm probably one of those 20% of people who say, oh, gender, bias, does it exist? Like, so it's down to mm-hmm. us, you know, mm-hmm. and I would have said that
mm-hmm.
because my experience was that, being in the corporate world, I worked in small, medium-sized enterprise, SME kind of mm-hmm. sector. So I think it was slightly different than a big corporation and a big mm-hmm. institution. I think it is different. I mean, I had female bosses, actually. And I would say I was never really, I was never personally held back.
Mm.
But then, you know, what I realise now is that I had a very masculine attitude mm-hmm. to work.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what was, but I went in with a bit naturally masculine attitude because I grew up around that environment, that kind of competitive environment. I didn't know how to be a girl, mm-hmm. actually. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I'm kind of learning, you know, now, I'd say. But, you know, but much later years, I've had to sort of really, what does it mean? You know, it still confuses me sometimes. But anyway, mm-hmm. I totally get the whole kind of like, the gender, you know, the non-binary, like, you know, why you would not want to identify one or the other because mm-hmm. we're all a mix. I totally get that, you know, and I think, but so it is. But I think, you know, now I reflect on that differently and I think, well, you know, and this is, and I guess this is the area that I'm sort of interested in with, particularly with the women I work with, is about, and the men I work with as well, is about how to be more feminine, actually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And bringing more of those feminine qualities. And it's a little bit what you talked about there, the corporate environment we go in with that competition and it's all metric measures and performance mm-hmm. and increasing all the time, which is that mm-hmm. kind of, it's an incredibly, you know, challenging environment to mm-hmm. operate within. And then coming out of that and then you're seeing much more collaboration, much more support, you know, much more a platform for, you know, to develop something that is really meaningful for you in a very creative way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that, and I guess that's what I mean. That's what I'd like to see more of. Mm-hmm. Actually, is much more of that kind of, you know, culture. Actually,
Yeah.
So, I mean, what do you think would have been different for you in the corporate world, if?
Well, I mean. No, a lot of the I'm writing a book on the subject, my experience, which I'm trying to, I'm trying to bring three things. I'm trying to bring my personal experience and a kind of survey of social history and the evolution of gender equality over the course of my lifetime. And one of the questions that interests me is, you know, what's changed and what hasn't changed.
Mm.
Many, it's very easy to focus on some of the things which are very, practical or very blatant discriminatory factors, which I've seen. If I'd had exactly the same career path, or at least the same succession of jobs and worked in the same succession of organisations as I have done, and I'd done that as a woman, I'm certain that I would have not reached the level of seniority that I reached within my final organization.
Right.
And there are a number of reasons for that. I mean, especially if I'd had the kind of family life that I've had as a father, if I'd been a mother, parenthood remains, particularly in Switzerland where I'm working today, I think even more so than the UK, remains a considerable sort of handbrake on women's careers.
Mm.
But, you know, I worked for organisations where that was codified quite explicitly. I'll give you an example. I worked for a company in which anyone who worked at less than 80% lost their corporate title.
Wow.
So if you were a vice president, if you went to work at 70% or 60%, you were no longer a vice president. And I can remember, you know, I experienced that as a manager, someone in one of my teams, you know, going through that and basically having to print new business cards without the word vice president on them. And I can remember challenging the HR department, which I subsequently went to work for at the time, and saying, you know, this is discriminatory. And they were like, no, it's not, because, you know, if a man works at 70%, he loses his title as well. Well, at the time, in a company of, I think there were probably 3,000
employees. When you say working at 70%, do you mean in hours or?
Yes, yeah. Basically, working, you know, 3.5 days a week.
Oh, I see. Going to, yeah, part.
So basically, it's directly correlating part-time working with corporate status.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And you know, they said, well, you know, if a man works at 70%, he loses his title. And at the time, in a company of 3,000 people, there was one man working part-time, and he wasn't even working less than 80%. It was, but there was this kind of, it was so ingrained within the corporate culture that you know, management wouldn't even recognise that as being gender discriminatory.
Yeah.
And that just, for me, that's kind of an embodiment of the patriarchy, because you're just blind to some of the things that are going
blind
on.
Of it, yeah.
And you know, if that's a very simple example, but you know, who did that impact most? That impacted women coming back from maternity leave, who typically in Switzerland will come back and work part time, because childcare is very expensive in Switzerland. So you know.
You look at this through your own lens, and if I had been born a girl, literally,
yes.
I would not have been able to.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm wondering what you think might have been the impact if the women hadn't been held back, if the women had been able to get the equal status.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously very difficult to imagine, particularly as you say, I mean, I wasn't working in huge organisations. Well, I did work for JP Morgan, but I worked in a kind of local office that wasn't that large. But it's difficult to reimagine an entire organisation with, you know, gender equal, gender balance at management levels and things like that. Mm. But there were certainly in pretty much all the companies I've worked for, there were unhealthy attitudes towards competitiveness amongst staff. There were cultural practices or you know, which excluded women, or expectations that if you wanted to get ahead, you needed to socialise in a certain way, which typically involved, you know, drinking and that sort of thing. So I think the culture would have been softer, and I mean that in a very positive way. But I think, you know, there's so much research now that shows that women collaborate better, that they they're more sensitive to risk, that, you know, they can bring elements to a management culture which an all-white middle-aged male management team is unable to envisage,
and who've never had to question themselves.
So
it's, and Mark's actually given us a question here. Let me just read this out, because he says it's interesting that we say things like a masculine attitude rather than an attitude that men tend to express more.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone can express attitudes and feelings, but to attach them to a gender might be part of the problem. Absolutely, Or how those it's absolutely right. So, or how those attitudes get valued different because of gender.
Absolutely.
An aggressive male can be seen as confident and winner, while an aggressive female can be seen as troublesome and disruptive. And it's absolutely right. And it's, I guess it's for the ease of you know, description that we talk about masculine and feminine, because, you know, we are all a mix of these. And I guess the point I'm trying to bring is that, you know, how we all benefit from these much more softer, more sort of, because we all actually, you know, it's not bad to be in competition. It's not, you know, it's not bad to be aggressive sometimes, you know, we can all, but it's about how we use that stuff, but, and also about balancing it much more with this softer side.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, I think Mark's alluding to, you know, labels as well, vocabulary that we use. You know, we'll, as you say, we'll, a man will be assertive, a woman will be aggressive, you know, or bossy or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, corporate culture has been so defined by the masculine mindset for so long. That it, yeah, we stick labels on things which reinforce prejudices and biases. I'm very skeptical about the whole unconscious bias movement, I have to confess, because, well, in the sense that most of the experience I've had of bias in corporate culture has been perfectly conscious.
Okay. Yeah
you know, for me, there's a difference between it being a conscious bias and the people being in denial or refusing to admit it, and genuinely unconscious bias. And I'm not when I say that, I'm not underplaying the importance of unconscious biases, because we all have them, and I have them, and a lot of them are being expressed also through my project. You know, I would probably see them as positive biases, but that's because I'm coming from my own position on the subject. But I do think that the unconscious bias has become, and unconscious bias training has become a kind of way out for it. And actually, I think that's another sign of the power, in a way, of the patriarchal. I'm always a bit wary of using the patriarchal, because it's a very emotive word, but the patriarchal system is the way in which some of these terms or these tools become ways of reinforcing that structure or giving men a way out. And I'll give you another example, the lean in movement.
I'm not a fan of.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, I think we have to recognize it's done lots of incredible things. And,
well, it's interesting because you spoke about this on your podcast.
Yes.
Matt, you talked about that, the pay scale.
Yeah.
And about how, you know, part of that, he talked about the benefits, but also the disadvantages of that actual movement. I think it's what you're going to talk about.
I mean, I think, you know, the movement, I think, you know, there are lean-in groups, thousands of lean-in groups around the world of women helping them each other.
Mm.
And that can only be a positive thing.
Yeah.
But as a man who accepts his male privilege, or the fact that he has male privilege, reading Lean In, it just read as a big cop out for me. Basically, it basically handed me a cop out. It handed me this thing that said, actually, it's up to women to.
It's up to women.
I don't have to do anything.
And this, and I guess this is my point about how women approach the workplace as well, and denying those feminine characteristics, if you like, or that softer side, because this is how you behave and this is how you get in the corporate world, head in the corporate world. And as I said, I kind of managed it. I was at one time in my life, not anymore, quite fine going out and drinking with the lads, and I don't have children, you know, so it's so that was how it worked for me. But I've been part of the corporate world for a while. So obviously my work is around self-doubt, and you know, and this is why I like working with self-doubt, actually, because what it does is it invites us into these kind of this part of ourself, which is more vulnerable, more gentle, and working with that. But obviously it's really uncomfortable, and it's you know, it's a really challenging ask for people. And in a way, that's what you're doing as well. You're inviting these men to doubt themselves.
Yeah,
and I have to say, the people who I'm asking to doubt themselves are people who are kind of already familiar with doubting themselves and willing to talk about it. But you're going to men, you know, tick box, white privileged men, And asking them, you know, when you're asking them to reflect, what would my life have been like if I'd been born a girl? You're asking them to doubt themselves. And
absolutely.
So how's it going?
I think there are, you know, I'm obviously not the expert on the subject, but I've thought a lot about, you know, why men are reticent to explore this. And I think that, you know, some men, it's maybe are afraid of more of the consequences of thinking about it. They're afraid of that, you know, once you recognize that you have privilege, then you have a duty to do something about it. So maybe they're a little bit afraid about that. You know, once you've seen your own privilege, you can't unsee it. So, you know, either you kind of go into denial or get about it again, or you feel that you have to start doing something about it. Mm-hmm. There are some that maybe their fear is actually about what they're going to have to give up going forward. You know, now I see my privilege. I'm, you know, if I act against it, then I have to be giving something up in order to.
So it's a threat to them. Yeah.
But there are some I think are maybe afraid that, you know, it's going to awaken feelings of guilt, and, you know, once they start thinking about it, they're going to realise that. Yeah. But I do think that the strongest reason for people avoiding the subject is that it does ask us to reevaluate everything that we've done. It probably asks us to recognize that in a different, fairer world, we wouldn't have achieved everything that we'd have achieved, or we would have to have behaved differently in order to do that. And you know, our self-worth depends not only on the value that we attribute to our achievements, but also our confidence in their legitimacy. And actually what you're saying to people is maybe your achievements aren't entirely legitimate. Well, that could be a perception. And so that is clearly a threat to your self-esteem. And the link between that and self-doubt is direct.
Mm.
And that's really why it seemed important to me to give men examples of, and again, I don't like to use the word role models, but they are, you know, people who have succeeded who are prepared to say, you know, honestly, if I think back at that critical point in my life when I got that break, if I'd been a woman there at that point in time, I wouldn't have been considered for that position or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, my generation, it's a curious quirk so far of the interviews that I've recorded for the episode, that all of the people I've interviewed are in their 50s. So they were all at university in the 80s. University, particularly in the UK and particularly where I was at the time, was still massively dominated by men. I was at Oxford. It was 70% men, 30% women at the time. So, and actually now, today, this is one of the areas where there's been a lot of progress has made. There's actually a majority of women at Oxford and Cambridge today, not, you know, without talking about all of the other excellent universities that are out there. But, you know, if I'm honest, in terms of my academic achievements and my work ethic, I won't necessarily talk about capacity, but what I'd actually done at school and the effort that I put in at school, I was probably a borderline candidate to get into Oxford. I shouldn't have been a borderline candidate, but I was a very lazy, rebellious teenager.
So you had the intention, so I kind of got in, have the
Yeah, so I think I got in a little bit by the skin of my teeth.
Right.
That means that I'm on that frontier between the 70 and 30.
Yeah,
I was probably taking the place of a woman, a girl who was as bright as me, but who'd probably worked harder and deserved their place more than I did.
Yeah.
Now, you know, you don't think about that at the time. I didn't think about it at the time. One of the questions I ask my guests very often is, you know, were you aware when you were at university, or did you have the sense that the women were having a different experience from the one you were having? And we all agreed that we never thought about it.
Yeah.
And that's another privilege, you know.
Yeah,
and one of the things I've been doing for my book is going back and asking women who were at university with me at the time about their experience. And it's kind of eye-opening. But actually, I was able, when I started really working through my memories, I was able to find plenty of incidents of quite explicit, you know, privilege on my part and discrimination against women while I was there. And it, you know, it was a even at Oxford, you know, Dreaming Spires and all that, but it was a laddish, masculine, macho culture.
Well, I've heard.
I think it's probably a lot less so today. Well, yeah, I was a contemporary of some of the people. I didn't know any of those people.
But, yeah.
You know, I was almost a direct contemporary of the Boris Johnsons and the Camerons and all these sorts of
things. Yeah.
Fortunately, they were doing their things in another corner of the city.
All their boys' clubs.
Yeah.
So Mark, it just comes to the time here that I open up, and Mark is here, and I don't know if you want to come into the conversation, Mark, you'd be very welcome to just unmute yourself and put your camera on. Often might be doing something as well, but if you want to do that, you're very welcome to come on. He's already contributed here, but yeah, just to say that. We'll carry on chatting, and if he wants to come on, we'll just put it off.
But,
it's interesting, you're talking about privilege there, and it's like, well, just didn't notice, it's what you notice, and I've made this definition in the book actually, that privilege is not what we can afford to buy or where we can afford to go, it's what we can afford to ignore.
Absolutely.
Really.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so that's in a way, you know, in order to recognize our privileges, we have to start doubting ourselves and asking ourselves those difficult, uncomfortable questions. And so it's understandable that, you know, why would you want to go there if you've got everything, if life is comfortable for you.
Indeed.
You know, and, you know, it's going to be threatening to ask those questions.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the challenge, part of the challenge that we've got to get over, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. But I think it's an important conversation. And there are a lot of people doing fantastic work in related areas around that, talking about other aspects of, you know, toxic masculinity and things like that. But I think, you know, one thing that struck me and one of the reasons why I wanted to do this project was there are a lot of books. There's a lot of literature, there's a lot of movements and organizations out there which are trying to help women and give women advice on how to, you know, fight for their places in the workplace and in life in general. It's absolutely not limited to the workplace. But there's very little material out there written from the men's perspective. On this subject, there is quite a lot of literature by men about masculinity, about what it is to be a man, but it's much more about the damage that toxic masculinity does to men, which is an extremely important subject, but it's not where I want to go at all. But there's very little about privilege, and you know, I like to say that I think we men typically have a very asymmetrical view of discrimination. Those of us who recognize that sexism is a thing, those of us that recognize that sexual discrimination exists, we tend to think of it in terms of poor women rather than lucky us.
Right.
And so yeah. Initiatives to address discrimination tend to be focused, or especially when there are men behind them, tend to be focused on helping women up to a certain level, but not about thinking, well, you know, would we really actually all be better off if you took some of our privileges away?
Yeah.
And so that's really the angle that I'm trying to take.
That's fantastic. Yeah. And have you learned anything from your guests so far that's really surprised you?
Have I learned anything that's really surprised me? Without giving too much away about episodes that haven't been published yet. No, I think it's very interesting. I think a lot of what I've learned has actually been confirming what I suspected.
Right.
And I've already alluded to some of that. So, you know, most of us were happily living in our blissful, privileged male bubbles. Certainly well into our adulthood, well into our 20s, without ever asking ourselves the question. And that's an area where I think and hope that society has changed a bit. I look at my son, who's 27. I think he's grown up much more sensitive to, well, A, with a much better, a much clearer conception of social justice and equality. And I think has embraced much more openly empathy and compassion which I think were things that I always felt, but I think we as boys weren't necessarily encouraged to admit to them or to show them.
Well, they're seen as weak.
Yeah. They certainly were 30 years ago. So, you know, I think what's been very common amongst all the interviews I've had is there's been a lot of post-rationalisation.
Right.
And so the first thing is saying, well, that's not a problem. We're not here to flagellate ourselves about what we didn't do right in the past. We're here to be better in the future.
Yeah.
So I tried to make that very clear with my guests, and I'm not going to try to push them to say things that they don't want to say, and I certainly don't want them to end up going on, you know, guilt trips about what they failed to do in the past. But
that's not helpful.
But I think it's very telling about our generation. I'm looking forward to interviewing younger people, and maybe some older men as well. I'm also looking forward to interviewing some women. I should point out that one of the ideas on the project was that every fifth or sixth episode would be a flip the script if I'd been born a boy.
Oh, right.
Interview with a successful woman. It's been difficult to convince successful women to sign up before having released anything about the podcast. And it was difficult enough to get men on board, but you know, it's been very difficult to convince people to sign up for a podcast on a sensitive subject like that when they think, you know, we have no idea what we're letting ourselves in for.
What is this about?
What is going to be? So I think hopefully now people will get the chance to listen to episodes and approach that. But so I think that was the other thing is, and again, I don't want to be pointing fingers at anybody or mentioning any specific. It's always interesting to see the areas in which even men who are quite open to this sort of discussion, the areas in which they're relatively quick to acknowledge their privilege, and the areas where they're more reluctant, or where they have much more difficulty envisaging the impact that, you know, having grown up as a girl and as a woman would have had on their life. So, you know, there are guests who will say, if I'd been born a girl, I wouldn't be where I am today.
Yeah.
And then there are guests who say, well, if I'd been born a girl, I'd have been just as successful. I'd just been successful in something different.
Right. Yeah.
And it's, you know, that for me was actually a surprise, because I kind of assumed that anyone who agreed to go into the conversation would be thinking more along my lines, which is my personal belief that I wouldn't have achieved what I achieved. And I certainly didn't have an incredibly successful career, but I had a very respectable, you know, sort of middle class career that ended up in senior management. Mm. But I didn't necessarily expect people to be saying, actually to end up reinforcing certain stereotypes by saying, well, if I'd been a woman, I'd have been I'd have been successful in a more feminine profession and I wouldn't have done what I did. So it's, but every interview is a learning experience. And every response is legitimate. That's the other thing is, you know, one of the things that we've been drifting away from self-doubt perhaps during the conversation, but one of the things that directly relevant to the question of self-doubt for me was, I mentioned it earlier, is you think you've got a great idea, and then just as you're about, you feel ready to unleash it on the world, you start to come up with all the reasons why people will think that it's no good.
Yeah.
And I've had two experiences in the course of launching this podcast where actually my hand was forced. One wasn't really a hand, one was forced. One was I invited my first guest at the end of a horrible week when I was feeling miserable at everything, and I thought, I won't say the F word on your show, but
I don't mind if you do.
But it's basically what I said to myself, is like, fuck it, I'm just going to write to someone and invite them, because if they accept, then I have to do it.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel ready, but actually I'd been ready for months, but I'd been, you know, in this kind of perfectionist, procrastinating, bizarre sort of thing that we self-doubters do.
Yeah.
And of course, the guy who was Matt Wallett wrote back within half an hour and said, "Oh, it sounds like a great idea. Do you want to record it now?" sort of thing. And I was like, oh my God, I'm not ready. the other one was when I decided to actually publish and launch the episodes. I lined everything up in my publishing platform and scheduled everything to come out a few days later, and then went back to some other work I was doing, and I suddenly started getting messages from people saying, "Congratulations, this is really great, you've launched your thing." And I was like, "No, I haven't. I've scheduled it to launch in a few days' time, and I missed, you know, I've made a mistake with one of the parameters, and I basically published everything already." So all these messages were coming out saying, "It's going live now." I mean, without those, I would probably still be in my self-doubting cycle. And I'd still be thinking of all the perfectly legitimate reasons why some people won't like what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And it all comes back to this competitive thing and this, less the competitive thing, this comparing thing. You know, life is a journey. It's a learning journey. And it's devalued if we're intimidated the whole time by thinking about others and their achievements and thinking that others are judging us. You know, it isn't ultimately a competition, and you know, as long as you're doing something authentically, and you're putting the best of you into it, it's a very hard lesson to learn. I was a lesson at my daughter's school. My daughter's four, and they have this great thing where they give lessons to the adults so that the adults know what the kids are being taught.
Right.
And it's a kind of slightly progressive school, so. She has mindfulness lessons, and this morning we went, and the mindfulness teacher gave us a lesson as if we were kids.
Mm.
And I sort of sat there and I thought, they're teaching her everything she needs to know about all of this stuff. They're teaching her not to compare yourself with others, not to worry about what other people think, but at the same time to be interested in what other people are doing and empathetic. And I've spent 50 years, you know, agonizing over all of that, and I'm only discovering it now. So hopefully I'll have enough energy in what's left of my career and my life to conquer my self-doubt, because I agree with you, to harness my self-doubt and to use it as a way of pushing myself to do the best I can.
Yeah, well, I hope you do, because I think what you're doing is important, and I think you're doing it well, and I see your passion behind it and your desire to get it right as well.
There's my self-doubt again. The jury's out.
Well, there we go. Anyway, we have come up to time. So just to finish off, Tom, you know, where can people find you?
They can find me pretty much anywhere they look at the moment. There are probably people thinking, where can I hide from him at the moment?
Oh, no.
So, you know, I have a website, which is www.ifihadbeenbornagirl.com.
Yeah.
And then If I Had Been Born a Girl has accounts on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and even a YouTube channel. But it's basically the same stuff everywhere you go. So please don't feel that you need to go and look everywhere. You'll find the same thing. It's, you know, I'd be delighted if people go to their preferred social media platform and they'll find us there.
I'll make sure I put a link in the email that I'm sending out tomorrow. So thanks for being with us today, Tom.
Thank you, Olivia. I haven't talked enough about what you're doing. I love what you're doing too.
No, that's fine. Yeah. Thank you. Just to say, next week I have Carol Duyo. I can't pronounce her name. She's coming on and we're talking about being a multi-potentialite. So I hope you will join us next week, and thanks for joining us, Tom. And
thank you.
Goodbye.